You're Right to Say It, a program in its sixth year on television. Tonight, presenting a program entitled The Question of Broadcast Ratings. Our guest for this evening is Mr. Ernest H. Clay, Research and Production Director, American Research Bureau, one of the better-known broadcast rating companies. And to question our guest, Terry Turner, television critic for the Chicago Daily News, and Lawrence Laurent, television radio editor for the Washington Post. Now, here is guest moderator Glenn Mills, Assistant Dean of the School of Speech at Northwestern University.
Good evening. Recent congressional committee hearings on the business of television audience measurement and rating have aroused a lot of general public interest in this question. What do the ratings mean? Are they genuine or are they fakes? What are we supposed to believe and what aren't we supposed to believe? Is there some funny business going on here or is this all above board? Well, to help us answer these questions, we have these three knowledgeable men here today whom I should like to have discuss this question, the question of broadcast ratings. Let's begin by asking a gentleman in the business, Mr. Clay, what do we mean by a broadcast rating?
Well, Dean, broadly speaking, what we mean by a broadcast rating is the figures which are estimates of the audience tuned to a station or a program.
Well, I'd like to ask a couple general questions for the benefit of viewers who are vaguely familiar with ratings. They know ratings in the terms of the top 10, or they know that a show has gotten a rating of 20 or 30. What do you mean, for example, if you would explain to them what a rating of 30 means?
Well, when I ask this question, the answer that I usually give is that the 20 or 30 that you speak about, which is, by the way, the most common type of rating, is simply the percentage of the homes that are able to receive a program that watch it. Thus, if your top program in Chicago gets a rating of 30, this would mean that 30% of the homes with TV in the Chicago area were watching the program.
Well, the second question, obviously, is where do you get this figure of 30%? Who tells you? How do you operate to find the statistic?
Well, there are a great many different means for measuring television audiences. ARB employs primarily the diary technique. Now, this is a term we use to describe a method that entails calling up families, asking them to participate in your survey, and then sending them a little booklet, which we call the diary. And this is a form in which they keep a record for a full week of their viewing. These are then returned to us, and it is from these that we tabulate our results.
How many will you ask, Mr. Clay, in a city the size of Chicago, for example, how many people will you ask to fill out the little booklets?
Well, in the case of our latest Chicago report, we actually had 458 families who cooperated and did return these. In order to get that, we have to ask in the neighborhood, in this case, of around 900 families to cooperate.
Now, I have the ultimate question that is always asked me when we get into a discussion of ratings, and I will pass it on to you. How can 458 people in Chicago tell you what 2 million television homes are watching?
Well, I like to quote Jim Seiler on this. Jim has a very nice response.
This is your boss?
That's right, excuse me. Jim Seiler. His response on this, in regard to small samples, generally goes this way. If you feel that a small sample is inadequate to measure a large total, remember this the next time you have a blood test.
Now, don't go too far there, Henry. We're right into the area called scientism the minute we hit this. We go from a fixed situation where you can control other factors. We jump into human behavior, where we multiply, I gather from the testimony before the committee, by about 7 million, the number of variables available to us. And they're not the same thing at all. They are not comparable, really, are they? It's a good, quick answer, I'll grant you. And Jim uses it that way, I'll grant you that. But it really isn't a definitive test, is it?
Well, your answer, I would answer you this way. It is certainly, like all analogies, false.
Thank you.
Because they are such. It is simply a means of illustrating the concept which does underlie both of these, and that is the concept of probability theory.
What's the plus and minus factor of error there? How big is the margin for error in projecting from, let's say, 400 homes to the 2 million people, 460 homes to the 2 million people in Chicago? How big could your error be there? When you say a 30 rating, it could be as small as how much and as big as how much?
Right. Well, this I can get very easily from the back of our report here. For instance, let's take this program we spoke of, which may get a 30 rating.
Yes.
Now, with a sample size of 458, which was the one for this report, I quote that correctly, yes. We would get, for a rating of 30, about, we would say, with 95% chance of being correct, that rating fell between 26 and 34.
Anywhere from 26 to 34.
That's correct.
But, Hank, you do know through no fault of the American Research Bureau that in spite of this variation, these things are used with great precision. There was testimony before that committee. If the cost was $2.96 per thousand, that was all right. If it got up to $4, to $3, an increase of 6 cents dropped the program, it no longer is a good sales vehicle.
Well, certainly, the way these things are used, each individual user of ratings has his own means, I'm certain, of using them. Insofar as the degree of precision, I'd like to say this point, which I think is often missed, that when you are buying, even though you have a range of error, and by the way, let me emphasize that statistical error is not the only error we're dealing with in these reports.
I quite agree with you.
There are other, such as the non-response, people who don't cooperate, that type of error. But statistically, if you consistently make your choice on the actual reported figure, this is known in statistics as the best guess figure.
Well, it was the guess I was trying to get in there as opposed to the precision. There is a body of people in the television industry who do use these figures with great, great precision.
Mm-hmm.
When I have raised the question about it being a guess, they turn and look at me as though I were insane and say, are you kidding? This is scientific.
Well, the fact, of course, is it is scientific, but it is still a guess.
Mr. Clay, I'd like, in what way is it scientific? Let's assume, just for the sake of the following question, that the 450 people can give a reasonable definition of what 2 million people are doing, assuming that, how were the 450 selected? Where did they come from? Who picked them? Do they represent the entire population, or do they represent everybody that lives on one particular side of town? How do you, as a researcher, making your survey, decide which 450 people are going to be involved?
Well, the ARB employs sampling from telephone directories. Now, the reason we do this is because telephone directories as such are the most current and up-to-date listing of families. They also encompass, in the Chicago area and most areas of the country, a very high proportion of all the families. So our system for measuring, taking Chicago as the example again, would be first of all to define a geographic area wherein the television stations that are located in Chicago have an audience.
This is called the universe, I believe?
This is correct.
In Chicago, for example, our stations reach over into Indiana and southern Illinois, Wisconsin, and over into Michigan.
That's quite correct.
So you're going to check people in all that area, is that correct?
That is correct. And what we do then is we essentially draw a number of what we call sampling points in each county throughout this defined area. And these are drawn proportionate to the number of homes in each one of these counties. And then we send out the diaries, we endeavor to get...
Now, wait a minute, I'm confused already. You've got the telephone directory in front of you. Now, do you just reach in and say, let's grab 20 people from this page and 20 people from this page, or how do you... You're just picking them at random out of the telephone directory,
right.
Is that correct?
I'm afraid that I tend to lapse into our lingo in the research business. What we use is a method of sampling from a given directory. Let's say that in the Chicago Metropolitan Directory, we wanted to get 350 people to cooperate, just in the Metropolitan or the Central Directory zone.
Uh-huh.
What we would do is estimate how many different columns we would have to go through in this directory. We'd take the total number of columns in the directory divided by 350. And then we would randomly draw a line of type, which is counted from the top of a column. And then every 10th column would give us 350. We would go through every 10th column then, looking at the line that we randomly selected, and say, this is a person who belongs in our sample. No. It's known as systematic selection.
So systematic selection gives absolutely no recourse to the people who represent other segments of this society. The point I'm making is you have not, as a researcher, said we will pick a sampling to represent the population exactly as it is. There are so many people with certain income levels. There are so many people who live in the suburbs, so many people live in the city, so many people with certain educational levels. But you're not taking that into consideration. You're just picking numbers out of a telephone directory.
There, I'd have to disagree with you. We are exactly taking that into consideration.
Well, even if we grant you that, Hank, and I'm willing to grant you,
I'm not willing
start
to grant
out
it.
A random selection.
Just a minute, I'm not willing to grant that. How can you? How is it?
Maybe I can clarify that briefly. The figures you speak of, such as income, ethnic origin, things of this nature, it's very difficult, number one, to get precise current figures on these. And what you are referring to is a stratified sample or a quota sample. We say we want so many high income, so many low income,
yes,
so many medium income.
And education.
But, or education, any one of these other factors. With random selection, which is a form of random sampling or systematic selection, you automatically pick these up if you have conducted this systematic selection in the proportions that they exist within the frame, the list of families you draw your sample from.
You hope.
In other words, these things automatically, well, you pick them up again, plus and minus sampling variance.
Before you go too far there, though, Hank, what happens when these people start returning your diaries with no thanks? Then what becomes of this random sample, supposedly picked to represent this entire universe perfectly? Now what becomes of it? You had to tap how many people to get 458?
Roughly 900.
900.
That's correct.
What happened to your random selection now in the loss here?
Well, what happens is you point out is that these people send it back to you and essentially say nuts.
Are we
or
fairly,
they don't even send it
are
back.
Are we fairly safe then in saying what the report would most accurately represent is the viewing patterns of those people who are willing to keep diaries?
Yes.
You would be
isn't it limited
most
to that?
Accurate in saying that?
Would I not be most accurate in having that description?
I think what he means is might this possibly represent different sorts of television viewing tastes? Might there not be some correlation between a willingness or unwillingness to cooperate and certain tastes?
That's right.
In
people
viewing,
who don't
yes.
want the thing in their house might may watch something else than people who do take.
This
the,
is quite true, and this is one of the biggest problem areas where we and other rating companies have devoted a considerable amount of research. Now,
but you do change your sample regularly.
We do. We are one of the companies who uses a fresh sample each
yes.
time we run a study.
Now, as a man in the ratings business, the largest ratings business in the world, I'm told, is the A.C. Nielsen Company. Its national sample comes off 1,200, usually about 1,000 operating audimeters, and I gather this is a fixed sample. What happens to a fixed sample as opposed to one that changes with each time you make a survey?
Well,
I don't ask you to address this to the A.C. Nielsen Company. I ask you to address this to the problem of the fixed sample.
In the area of fixed sample, you have advantages and you have disadvantages. And the same thing is true of the non-fixed sample. Let me just first say, the fixed sample gives you these advantages. That when a change occurs, and you're measuring the same families, the change is more significant than if you're using different families. And the reason for this is a change is a real change. It's not a chance probability change.
Is this not, again, an accurate reflection of those people who are willing to have audimeters in their homes?
In that respect, and I wish I could clean that one up, I'll get back to it in a minute. Certainly. Certainly, in the case of any kind of survey, the only absolute fact you can say is that I have here a record that these people have given me, and even the veracity of that may be subject to question.
I know that people who keep diaries and such things tell me that they sometimes forget to fill them out for a while, and they fill them in at the last minute in what they might like to have watched sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and they sometimes fill them out to reflect viewing patterns they wish that they had.
They do it in surveys about what books are you reading lately, don't they?
Yes, we have a great deal of information, I think, from various things on this kind of data. People won't tell you the truth is a problem.
You mean everybody's proud of watching Beverly Hillbillies?
Well, let's say there are sufficient people who are proud of it to let their wishes.
Well, if I were going to falsify a book, I'd put in the best possible cultural shows that had discussion groups and so forth. That wouldn't be put
not
in
if you
Beverly
disliked Hill. That kind of programming, you
that's
wouldn't
true,
carry.
That's true.
If you objected to that kind of programming, even if you saw it, you'd leave it out.
Interesting.
I think there is some evidence that people in lower educated, lower income groups have some kind of resentment against these educated kind of programs, and even if they were trapped into looking at one by, let's say, a high school senior in the house, they might not register this.
Well, I think what you've shown here is that when you select your people, some of them are going to take the book, some aren't,
Some of them are going to fill it out and some aren't. And you've got 450 who have returned it for Chicago. And you just looked up something that showed that the rating would vary from
26 to 30.
Well, this particular show here being a discussion show.
26 to 34, Terry.
This show here being a discussion show on scheduled in certain time periods throughout the country, and one particular area is up against a very, very popular network show. And in Chicago, for example, this show is lucky to get a rating of 1 or 2. Mm-hmm. Well, taking what you've got, your variance, I think you called it, this show either has no audience and we're wasting our time, or it has twice the audience that we think it's got, based on the book alone. Mm-hmm. Now you say that error is even greater, can be greater, because some people won't fill out the book.
On a
so
rating,
we've got a minus audience.
Well, on a rating of 1 or 2, it could be down close to 0. By the way, probability theory doesn't allow you to go into minus numbers.
Maybe somebody's calling and asking them to turn off the show.
I think,
what's the polite way for saying minus 0, 0.2 minus?
There are all sorts of different symbols.
Let me ask you about people with unlisted telephones, please. This has become quite a status symbol in our society.
Mm-hmm.
The telephone company tells me it's a great problem. Are we overlooking these people entirely?
Well, yes, currently we are. There are means of getting at these people, and they are rather interesting. Where this becomes a serious problem, we're in New York City, for instance. We're about 13%, according to the latest figures, of the families.
Would that not tend to be upper income groups?
This I don't know. I would think so. I would concur.
Since they're not charging a fee for it, I should think that would be an upper income group.
The way you can include them in your sample is simply to draw random telephone numbers, not from a telephone record, but just draw random five-digit numbers. And
you
this way
you
sit down and dial. Now, of course, a lot of your dialings are wasted.
That's very interesting.
But it is a means of including them, then, in the sampling frame.
Well, Hank, you would agree with me that they do exist, and we've had them parading before this Committee on Investigation. People in the ratings business who, from their own testimony, sat in our office and made up these figures. I think of one in Kansas City, for example, where Mrs. Jones, with the assistance of three or four people, they put out hundreds of rating reports a year with no discernible research done in the field. I don't say the American Research Bureau is one of these. In fact, I think you got a very clean bill of health from that committee. But you would agree with me they do exist.
Yes. Unfortunately, and I think this is true probably in almost every area of business, there are some who will try to go it, shall we say, by not performing what they claim to perform.
But then there are readings that are completely meaningless, fiction, that these do exist.
Certainly. I believe these were primarily in their radio ratings.
But do you rate network shows on a national level? You do, don't you?
We do that also.
Well, now, how many people do you ask there? You ask 450 here, for example, to find out what's happening in Chicago. How many do you ask to find out what's happening in the nation?
Well, our national network report is based on 1,500 homes responding.
So that's 1,500 people representing 188 million people.
That's correct. Well, it's homes representing roughly 50 million
homes.
That's,
pardon me. That's 1,500 homes representing 45 million or 50 million.
About 50 million homes all.
Do they change from month to month?
Yes, these change in every survey. ARB's general practice is to change the sample. By the way, let me get back to that. The advantage of changing a sample is that if you have a sample which has a bias in it one time, the next time you come around, your chances are you won't pick up that bias. As a matter of fact, the chances are extremely small that you can get the same bias twice in a row.
Hank, aren't you saying here that a single rating report is almost meaningless by itself?
No, I am not saying that.
What value is the single rating book to you, since you cannot see trends in it, and since it may represent a biased sample?
Well, trends certainly are a valuable piece of information.
This is several reports.
However, an unbiased estimate, which is the best guess that I referred to earlier, is also of value to you.
Now, if this thing is an error, I don't agree with the idea that personally, and I'm going off the CCNY statistician here, that if there's bias in this report, it is not better than nothing, it is worse than nothing, because it robs you of your own individual initiative and thoughts in these matters. Now, would you disagree with that?
I wish you'd restate that.
You'd probably disagree with it if you understood it.
I think you probably would. Dr. Arkin of the
Yes.
City College of New York Bureau of Statistics did not accept the argument put forth by many people from rating services that a report by itself, a single report, reflecting any kind of bias that might be in there. They said it was better than nothing. He said it was not better than nothing. It frequently was worse than nothing because it robbed you of the validity of your own thinking, your own initiative, your own estimates, and information that would come to you from other sources mail, personal responses, and so on.
Mr. Arkin, although he's an eminent statistician, has engaged in a non sequitur here.
A non sequitur?
It doesn't follow that because you're using a biased estimate, if it is biased, that necessarily you throw everything else to the winds.
I think Terry would agree with me that our own impressionistic information in this area is, once the book is there, this is the definitive word.
They do use it, as you well know, in the advertising agencies and at the network programming level and sponsor levels. In many cases, not in all cases, but in many cases, they buy a program or they sell a program or they set up a schedule based only on what the figure says on the little book here. And his point is that if this thing is wrong, and a guy has decided he's going to put a program on and thinks it might go, but the book says it, then mm-hmm. the system...
I was giving you an opportunity, I thought, to say what Mr. Seiler had said during the hearings, that nobody should make decisions based on a single rating report.
That's correct. We do recommend that people certainly should take into consideration a trend.
They do, though, don't they?
And many of them do. And again, because, and I don't mean to say that some people don't misuse these things. I'm certain there are a great many that do misuse ratings. But to indict the whole broadcast industry or the advertising industry because some misuse some facet such as ratings, I think is the problem that
I think your random projection is too great there. I don't think anybody has indicted the entire broadcast industry. I think it was mentioned as a factor in the ratings business.
The reason why people are concerned about it is because it sets up what they're going to see on television. And I have written maybe, I can't remember how many columns I've written about ratings. And it's a subject that's impossible to explain to readers and viewers because they are always confused by it. The only thing they know is that the industry is using ratings to establish programming that they, in all cases, don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, it's often misused. And I find it appalling that that an industry could base its decisions on something that can range 26 to 34 if everything was all right to begin with, which it wasn't. And I think the figures shown in Washington at the hearing was that one point on a network level could mean, what was it, right, $10 million, $1 million in revenue, some...
$100,000 per rating point, I believe, was one of the things they mentioned.
And, well, see, again, they're gauging and picking out extremes. And this,
I think it would be helpful if we had Mr. Laurent describe his experiences at the recent congressional hearings. I think we have talked around this point. Many of our viewers may not know that when these hearings were and what all came up.
Well, I try not to give you a very long answer, Gene Mills. Congress has been interested in this problem for at least 5 years. They commissioned a study by the American Statistical Association, which said in essence that statisticians endorsed methods used by statisticians, and that the rating services were more sinned against than sinning. Now, I have never, I hope, intimated that anybody was doing any fakery here in the ratings business, except for some companies we could describe, very small organizations. I think they do the best job they can based on the economics available. This has been demonstrated, I think, fairly well during those hearings. They went on for 6 weeks. It was, to say the least, a rather good education in statistical theory, random selection, projection, and the effect these have on the broadcasting business. It is incredible to me, as it is to Terry, that a billion-dollar industry would find itself tied so closely to something as ephemeral as this. And for this reason, I should mention that the American Research Bureau, as a result of these hearings, at least partly, is doubling its sample sizes throughout the country.
I saw a magazine item the other day that said this was just a grandstand play. Someone made this charge.
What the committee hearings were?
No, this doubling of the sample by ARB, American Research Bureau. Someone by the name of Kearney, I think it was, in some magazine, said, oh, that's just a grandstand play.
Well, I think certainly there are those who are opposed to the fact that when you do increase the quality, it's going to increase costs, and costs may come first in some instances.
Your particular rating service is, don't you concentrate most of your effort in finding out what's happening in local markets? You're not as involved in network programming as the A.C. Nielsen Company.
No, 90% of the network expenditures are for A.C. Nielsen Company reports, I believe, was the testimony, was it not?
That was roughly.
I don't think we'll go into why you got out of the national business, will we?
I don't think there's any particular reason why we got out. We've been trying to get in for some time.
This was not as a result of a lawsuit filed against the Arbitron system, which they have on the board over there?
No, as a matter of fact, that Arbitron system has quite some time ago been
settled. What's an Arbitron system?
Arbitron is another measurement system, which actually is based on electronic devices, which are actually wired into the home and run over leased lines into a central computer. And if they shoot the board in, if they want to get the picture of the... These homes are wired into this reporting board, and the lights will light up opposite each station in proportion to the audience tuned to that station. This is currently in use only in New York.
You mean if I want to find out what the ratings are, I can look at those little lines and see lights flashing?
Terry, it was known in the trade in the days when it was running as instant ulcers.
Instant ulcers.
You could stand and look at the board and watch this 300 sample in New York, tune in and out, for example.
Well, if one of those lights burned out, wouldn't that mean that maybe a series could be canceled for the whole year and three people thrown out of work in Hollywood and three in New York? And
I think you addressed your question to him and not me.
One little 5-cent light just burned out. Well, I mean, that obviously is not the case, but Arbitron is, as you've explained, instantaneous measurements.
Yes,
instantaneous. The signal electronic comes right from the set in and shows up on that board.
That's correct. Now,
producer watched it very carefully. He could say, get that cowboy back out, sets the news one up 20% while he was on here.
To be a little bit more seriously, what is the purpose of the board itself? Nobody can sit there and study it. You release printed reports about what is happening. Well, why the board? Why the actual board?
Well, it's like Confucius said, a picture's worth 1,000 words, and this is simply for people to come in and observe, because the printed report does come out of the computer, actually.
Mm-hmm. And you do not do radio measuring at all in your company, do you?
We are not engaged in radio measurement.
Would you tell me why you don't engage in that?
Well, I'm sorry, gentlemen, but our time is up. Saved by the bell. Our thanks to our guests for this evening, Mr. Ernest H. Clay, Research and Production Director, American Research Bureau, Terry Turner, television critic for the Chicago Daily News, and Lawrence Laurent, television radio editor for the Washington Post. We hope you will join us next week when our guest will be the Honorable John F. Henning, Undersecretary of Labor. Thank you and good night.
I disapprove of what you say. But I will defend to the death your right to say it.
Your Right to Say It, a program in its sixth year on television, is a presentation of Northwestern University and WGN Public Affairs. Guest moderator was Glenn Mills, Assistant Dean of the School of Speech, Northwestern University. Your Right to Say It is produced and directed by Robert W. Thomas and J.R. Gregoris. George Bauer speaking.